It's 8 minutes after 5 o'clock, and we say good morning and welcome to the Saturday Morning Show here on WGN Radio Chicago. Orion Samuelson with you for our weekly get-together here on Saturday morning, and we're looking at a weather situation outside my broadcast studio in Huntley, Illinois at 63 degrees this morning, but it looks like we could be in for a pleasant day today as we continue our move toward the beginning of fall. Lots to talk about this morning, but I was sitting here thinking as I was looking at my Reuters screen this morning, what I used to check when I first sat down at the microphone in the morning and what I'm checking first of all today. For example, as I look down the headlines, South Korea floods, landslides kill 21 as heavy rains continue in that country. Russia reports more than 5,200 new coronavirus cases. And the worldwide coronavirus cases count is now at 19,450,000. Deaths on the planet from coronavirus totaling 720,789 people. And yet people are not taking the pandemic seriously, as we hear every day on some of our newscasts. And yet when you see that kind of account worldwide, a lot of people have already died from the coronavirus, so I think we take it seriously. Country of Indonesia, overnight, 2,277 new corona cases. And the Philippines is showing a large number this morning. And countries from all over the world are checking in with the coronavirus count. So this morning here on the Saturday Morning Show, well, we have Jim Fizell, as Matt mentioned earlier. Jim Fizell will be with us. But there's one interesting report that Max Armstrong will share with us this morning that talks about a 100th anniversary of what? The American Soybean Association. Max Armstrong was involved and participated in the 100th anniversary celebration that was held in Camden, Indiana this week. And an interesting story behind the beginning of the American Soybean Association, a group that is supported by soybean producers with their funds to promote the use and the consumption of soybeans on the planet, especially here in the United States. And one of the interesting stories that came out of that gathering this week in Camden, Indiana, to celebrate is the story of the Fout family. Not all of you know the family name F-O-U-T, Fout. But a lot of you who are my age listened to the one Fout brother who is known in the broadcast community as Captain Stubby. My golly, I worked with Captain Stubby for quite a few years at various events, at Farm Progress shows and so on. One of the funnier people I've known in my lifetime, and it was Captain Stubby and his brothers who were involved in the formation and the beginning of the American Soybean Association. So Max will join us for that report this morning, and I hope you'll find it interesting, because I certainly did, since I did shows with Captain Stubby. He used to be on WLS Chicago, the Prairie Farmers Station, and one of the joys of my life, the opportunity to laugh at Captain Stubby's jokes and to enjoy his company at farm shows like the Farm Progress Show and the other shows that we used to hold and conduct, but not this year because of the coronavirus situation, COVID-19. So those are some of the things we'll be doing this morning here on the Saturday Morning Show. And as I said, 63 degrees, and we'll check in with Jim Fazell when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Well, good morning, Jim Fazell. My golly, we've got a busy morning ahead of us because we're going to repair our lawn. Is that right?
That's right, Orion. You can't do it in one day, but you need to start now. Actually, August is a prime time for repairing lawns in this part of the country. Usually, expect a little bit more moisture than we get earlier in the summer, and we usually expect temperatures to be moderating, and they have done that in the last week. And of course, we're going to get some warm weather this coming week, but summer's not over. If you look at the beginning of summer and the beginning of fall, and you try to measure the number of days in between, you end up with August 5. We still have half of summer to go. We can't kill the summer before it's done. So we have lots of time to do stuff. We don't need to be in any hurry, and we need to do these things, taking our time to do them right. So August is the prime time to prepare lawns, and we do need to start now. Actually, if you're a commercial turf grass grower, some of the sod farms around here and so forth, they aim for something like the 15th of August to begin seeding. That's a little ways off yet, but it gives us time to do some preparation. There are several ways to approach this thing. First of all, if you have a thatchy lawn, and a lot of them get that way, particularly lawns that are well taken care of, you need to core aerify those lawns. And that is done with a machine that puts a hole every 2 inches through the lawn. That means that some of these lawn care companies that come out with a machine that has tines at 6 by 8 inches, that's 48 inches. You really want 4 inches. 2 by 2 is 4 inches. So if you have one of those old-time lawn coring machines that only makes a hole every 48 inches, you need to go over it 12 times to get it right. Well, nobody will do that. And by the way, if you do that, you're really going to mess things up. So if you're going to core aerify, find a core aerification machine that has the tines at 2 by 2. Most of the good landscape contractors either have them or will get a hold of them. And of course, golf courses all have them. That's the standard. The 2 by 2 is the standard. And our athletic fields like Wrigley Field and Cubs Park and so forth, where they do a core aerification, their machine puts a hole every 2 inches. That's what it needs to do it. We had a mutual friend at one time that I convinced to do that. And he said, look, it looked like the elephants had gone through his front yard. But about 3 or 4 weeks later, he said, you were right. It's beautiful now. So you got to do it right. Now, once you have it core aerified, if that's what you need, there are several ways you need to approach this. First of all, if you just have some bare spots in your lawn or dead spots where the chinch bugs got in it or the kids played out there and tore some of the grass out, you don't need to repair the whole lawn. You need to scratch those spots up. If there's duff in there from thatch, you remove it, put that in your garden someplace, and take some fresh soil and fill that little low spot. Now, once you get those spots filled up and even and worked up so that you can have a kind of a seed bed, a little bit of loosened soil. Seed those spots, hand seed them, gently rake the seed in, and you can cover them if you want to. Now, you can use just a handful of straw, and you can get straw at garden centers right now, bales of straw. Also, if you're going to do a lot of this, there is a mat. It's actually a woven mat of wood fibers that can be used as a cover. Now, if you're going to do a lot of it, it may be worth time for you to go buy one of these rolls of these, and they're not expensive, and you can keep them from year after year if you need to. So that's how you work up the little bare spots. Now, if you have a lot of bare spots in your lawn, maybe 50% of it has been torn up or bugs have gotten into it, the sod webworms or the grubs, so you've got a lot of bare areas out there. It may be advisable to redo the whole lawn, but you don't need to dig it up to do that. The way to do that is to either slit seed the thing or to power rake it so that you have grooves going through the lawn and then seed it. Now, you do that, first of all, by cutting the grass very short, making sure that you don't have any low spots or high spots in the lawn, which you can, if there's just a couple of those, you can redo that by hand. When you get the lawn in fairly good shape, then slit seeding or power raking and then broadcast seeding will put seed down very nicely. It will put the seed down in rows. Now, if you're going to do either one of those, you need to make these rows north and south or east and west in your lawn or whatever direction you want to start, and then at a bias, and that means at about a 45-degree angle, so you don't have rows of corn out in your lawn, narrow rows, of course. These slit seeders are like miniature conservation drills. They have a blade that cuts into the soil. They drop the seed behind that, and they have a press wheel behind that. They work beautifully, but if you can't get somebody to do that or don't know somebody that has one of those, you can do it with a power rake, which makes the grooves, broadcast seed, and after you get it broadcast seeded in there, you may want to roll it to get that seed pressed in. Now, if your lawn is a disaster, it's got a lot of weeds, all kinds of grasses, it's up and down, there are low spots that get wet in the rainy weather, and you can't walk out in the lawn because you got a swamp out there, complete renovation. This is the time you need to do that. First, whether you're seeding or sodding these, you need to get rid of the perennial weeds and all the things that you don't want growing out there. This means that you need to kill everything off, and what we use is glyphosate. Spray it with glyphosate or have it sprayed with glyphosate. Wait 5 days to make sure that it's all going to be killed off. Make sure there are no spots that you've missed. Then you need to strip the lawn off. That means that you do it by hand, or you rent a sod cutter or something like that, take all the lawn off. You don't want to dig this stuff back in. You want to remove it, put it into the yard waste or wherever you can put it to get rid of it. Actually, what we do with it is we put it into the garden, turn it over, and use it kind of as a compost to add to the garden soil. Now, once you get that done, you do need to do the leveling to fill in the low spots and to cut down the high spots. Once you get it leveled, then you need to prepare your seed bed. You can do this with a garden rake if the soil isn't too heavy. I know some of the people that do this use a sod cutter. After they've gotten the sod off, they'll set the sod cutter a little bit low, run it back and forth, so it loosens a couple of inches of that topsoil that makes the seed bed. Then sod it or seed it. If you're going to seed it, you need the slit seed, or you need the seed in two directions. Now, you can slit seed as well, but it's not necessary to do it once you have all that other grass off. You can seed in two directions to make sure that you get good coverage, and then you need to rake that in. Now, the way I do it is I turn one of these grass rakes, the ones with the wire tines in it, upside down, drag that back and forth, and it will push the seed gently into where it belongs in the soil, where it's going to grow very nicely. Once you get that done, this time of year, we can usually rely on moisture, but I think it's probably more advisable this year, since we seem to be having more dry weather than wet, to prepare to wet that seed. And once you begin wetting it, you need to keep it wet until it germinates. This means putting moisture on there every day or every couple of days to keep it moist. Now, another thing that you can do to improve the germination is to use this fiber mat that I talked about. Lay this out across the lawn. You can water through it. The grass will begin to grow through it. It's held down with wire tines, which incidentally you need to count to make sure when you pick this stuff up you don't leave those out in the lawn. So if you put down a dozen of them, make sure you collect a dozen of them when you pick this stuff up. But that will keep the grass shaded, moist, very nicely, and some of this grass seed will be up within a week. Within 2 weeks, you probably can take the mat off, and in probably 3 or 4 weeks, you're going to have grass up that will be just about ready to mow from seeding. Now, if you're going to sod, the process to prepare is exactly the same. Now, if you're buying sod, be sure that the sod you get is fresh and it was grown on the same kind of soil as you have in your yard. If you have a sandy yard, get sand-grown sod. If you have a clay yard, don't get peat sod, get clay-grown sod. Make sure that what you get is like what you have on your yard, because it will knit much more easily and it will avoid a lot of problems later. Get the sod laid down, making sure the joints are tight. Roll the ferment down and begin watering. Once the sod is down there, it needs to be kept wet for a couple of weeks. If you're in a community where you have a watering restriction, you need to check with the authorities there to make sure that they'll allow you to put the water down on your grass, on your new sod, for the 2 weeks or so until it's knitted. Most of them will have no problem with allowing you to do that, but they do need to know about it, or you'll get yourself a little ticket. Nobody needs one of those. Anyway, there's some ideas about what you can do to get your grass growing, get your sod laid down, get your lawn looking very nice, And actually, if we start about right now, you're going to have a pretty nice lawn by the time the summer's over and fall sets in. And certainly by next spring, the grass is going to be in good shape so that you'll have no problem with a beautiful lawn next spring.
But I'm a little tired listening to you. It sounds like it's quite an event to do the lawn by sod or seed. Which it's one would you do?
What would I do?
Yeah.
Don't ask me. I had a good friend who's a landscape contractor here go in and redid my parkway just about a year ago, and it's worked very nicely. You know, yeah, I used to do a lot of this. In fact, Jane and I have sodded properties, and I've done a little bit of it on the side. It is a lot of work. It's a tremendous amount of work. But, you know, there are a lot of young people right now that are home. They're looking for something to do. And one of the things that they can do is to begin on a small scale. If you have a sizable yard and you have only part of it that needs some work, go out and try it. Work that part out. Figure out how you're going to do it, where you're going to get the tools that you need to do it, and do it. If you do one little spot this fall, you may decide that next spring you're going to do another little spot, and pretty soon you'll have the whole thing done. And I've seen big estates where the people say, oh, gosh, I need to have all this done, but I can't afford to have it all done at one time. You pick out the spots that are most highly visible, the ones that you're going to see all the time. Fix them first. Don't worry about the rest of it until later, so that eventually you'll have it all done. But the parts that you're really looking at to start with look real nice at the beginning, so you can enjoy them.
And if you do it well enough, you may have a whole new career. You may have a lawn seeding company. So,
that happens.
Yes, it does. So thank you very much for the advice on starting or renovating a lawn and having a beautiful yard by the time we get to fall and winter. Our visit with Jim Fazell here on the Saturday Morning Show. We're at 27 and a half minutes after 5 o'clock on what looks like a start of a pretty day, and we have been having some nice days with temperatures that are fairly comfortable. But the thing that I have said many times is the fact that despite the challenges we have with the COVID-19 situation throughout the world, here in the United States, as well as other countries, we've had some ideal growing conditions. It's quite a few years since I can remember growing conditions with the crop conditions above 75% rated good to excellent across the country. And we've certainly got that right now. So let's hope that we can get through the harvest season without a hurricane coming up the Mississippi into the Midwest, or without the problems from weather that we can have that we haven't had so far this year. The Saturday Morning Show, WGN Radio Chicago, a lot more to talk about. We'll look at markets for the week. We'll look at some heavy buying by China of our agricultural products. And so then, as I said, we'll have the 100th anniversary celebration of the forming of the American Soybean Association. That still to come here on the Saturday Morning Show. Again, 60 degrees outside my home and my studio in Huntley, Illinois, and what should be the start of a pretty good day. So at 5:30, we say welcome to Samuelson Says here on the Saturday Morning Show. I'm Orion. And I'll continue a conversation that I hear almost every day, either by email or by phone or whatever, and that is the effect of COVID-19 on the agricultural markets. There is a fair amount of discussion in rural America these days on the impact of COVID-19 on agricultural markets. So this week, I'd like to share with you information from a monthly publication, the Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer. which is based on a survey of 400 agricultural producers every month here in the United States, all across the country. The July survey conducted from July 20 to 24. So what has happened over the year? Well, the index rose just 1 point from June to July to a reading of 118, that is still 30% lower than in February. And then unchanged from June, 9 points lower than in May. 56% of producers reported they plan to reduce their farm machinery purchases compared to a year ago. 38% reported they plan to keep machinery purchases about the same as last year. And farmer sentiment in July did not change much compared to June, but it was still much weaker than in February before the impact of the pandemic. In July, farmers indicated they were less concerned about the current economic condition on their farm than earlier this spring, and yet they were less optimistic about the future. Over half of farmers responding to the July survey said they were less likely to attend in-person educational events in 2020. And when asked about their short-term outlook for land values, farmers' perspective improved. 16% saying they expect farmland values to rise over the next 12 months. And back in June, only 10% made that statement. So see how your thoughts currently would compare with those thoughts in the July barometer. Oh, and be safe, be well. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. A presentation of the Nexstar Media Group here at 26 minutes before 6 o'clock on the Saturday morning show. The markets, well, we'll take a look at them with Mike Pearson and his market guest here in a moment. And then toward the end of the hour, we'll check in with Max Armstrong, who took part in that 100th anniversary celebration of the American Soybean Association this week. So stay with us, because we're going to check in with Mike Pearson and his guest in just a minute or so when we continue here on the Saturday morning show. 25 minutes before 6 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show, the start of a nice Saturday, and whatever you plan to do, do it carefully and safely. Because, as I said a minute or so ago, stay well and be safe. The story that we have that caught my attention this week, because we've heard so much about the tension between China and the United States impacting trade between these two countries, and yet this week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture reported private sales of U.S. soybeans to China, 456,000 tons on Thursday, the biggest single-day soybean sale to the world's top buyer since June 11. Smaller sales were reported on Wednesday and Thursday, as well as sales to unknown destinations earlier this week on Monday. And the deals came despite the rising political tensions between Washington and Beijing. China's purchases of our products, corn, wheat, grain sorghum, soybeans, and pork, are continuing at a rapid pace without regard to any geopolitical tensions, according to Bill Lapp, who is president of Nebraska-based Advanced Economic Solutions. China's soybean imports rose 18% this year through July versus a year ago, as large volumes of soybeans from Brazil also arrived, according to Chinese customs data. The Asian country has increasingly turned to U.S. supplies in recent weeks, with the USDA reporting China bought nearly 5.2 million tons of U.S. corn, along with 3 million tons of soybeans and 320,000 tons of hard wheat since July 10. However, China still has a long way to go. It's far behind the pace needed to meet its commitment of buying $36.5 billion under a Phase 1 deal. The U.S. exported just 7.2 billion in agricultural goods to China in the first half of this year. So, despite the geopolitical tensions and the anger that we hear between China and the United States on other indications, they still are buying a fair amount of our agricultural products, and we'll hope that they'll keep buying so that we do get to that number that they committed to back in January when they signed the Phase 1 trade deal between the two countries. We're at 21 minutes before 6 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show. And to talk more about market activity, let's check in with our friend Mike Pearson.
Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net is joining us this week. Matt, thanks for taking the time to chat with us.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Well, I tell you what, looking ahead to this next week, we've got the August World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates Report coming out of USDA. As you look ahead, gaze into your crystal ball a little bit, what do you think USDA is going to do with this corn crop? Where do you think yields are going to come in?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Obviously, everybody's going to be looking first at yield. No question about it. I guess we have to look at the crop conditions a little bit. I know a lot of folks want to discount those, but you got to look at those and look at what we've done in the past. And so very similar rated crop back in 2018, USDA came in. Now, they were in the field. We all know that. And so only part of that was based upon surveys. But back in 2018, they came in at 181. You know, you're 5-6 bushel above trend line back then. Are they going to have something like that coming out again this year? I guess I would assume that it's going to come in well above 180, just based upon, you know, your survey-based approach. I do think the producers outside, especially of the stressed areas of Iowa, are probably going to be pretty high on their crop.
Gotcha. Now, when you think about a corn crop over 180 bushels, perhaps substantially over 180 bushels per acre, you know, we've seen the December contract lose about 40 cents since early July. Have we priced in a monster crop this year?
You know, that's a really good question. I've got to think that if we didn't have some of these nice sales, surprise sales here in the last couple, 3 weeks from China, you know, 2 million ton last week, obviously, huge sale that we weren't necessarily expecting. I think that the market would have struggled to keep this 320 support. Are we going to see more sales like that moving forward? I do think that we've probably priced in a pretty good sized crop. Have we priced in a 183 or 184 like some of us are projecting for this August report? Maybe not. So I think it remains to be seen. It's going to be moving parts. I think a lot of things are at play, though. I mean, you're looking at some inflationary stuff going on. Obviously, the dollar's been very weak lately. So there's some things that are actually supporting the corn market that maybe we weren't counting on previously.
Well, now, how about soybeans? Of course, as we head into the month of August, this is the key month of growing season for that soybean crop. What are you guys looking at for expected yield on this USDA report?
You know, for beans, we're looking at around 51.4, 51.5, you know, right in that neighborhood. We feel like they'll come in August and it'll be above what they're projecting previously, just due to the fact that, again, you've got really good crop conditions. Are you going to see a really large yield here in August? It's probably a little early to be able to post something like that. But I think that if the forecast verifies moving ahead, looking forward, Mike, I've got to think that this yield that they post here next week could probably grow in future reports. I mean, I feel like this bean crop could be rather large. I think we set the table for it with a really good fall last year and a really good spring this year. And so we were able to see early planting. We know that typically is conducive to really good yields. So I think this bean crop actually is quite large.
Now, from a technical perspective, given that we do have potentially a large soybean crop coming, that 880 level in November seems to be a decent level of support. Does that carry forward post-report, do you think?
Yeah, again, that's a great question. I think that there's still some moving parts there. We know that Chinese purchases have just continued to be fantastic for the market. You know, we've been able to see sales every week of late, you know, that I think have just been nothing but a pleasant surprise. And so are we going to continue to see those? And I do think that if the Chinese keep buying, even if the crop's big, you probably at least see some support in that area.
Matt, before we jump off the topic completely, WASDE coming out, what are your carryout expectations for corn and soybeans?
You know, I think even if we come out with a large yield like we're projecting, we're still going to be below 3 billion bushels. You know, you might end up seeing a new crop carry in that 2.9 area, 2.8.5, 2.9. You know, but bottom line, I don't think it's going to get wildly out of control. You know, as some people suggested maybe a couple months ago, as far as soybeans are concerned, you know, I think in that 5-5.50 range is probably going to be a safe place to be unless they get a little aggressive on the upside on yield, which again, I really don't think that they're going to do for this report.
All right. Well, you mentioned earlier the weakening of the U.S. dollar. This has been a trend that's been in place for about 6 weeks. Certainly should be beneficial to the wheat market. We've seen a lot of volatility in wheat. Is that going to continue?
You got to hope that you'll still see some volatility. I mean, traders love to see volatility. We know that. But, you know, as far as the wheat market rallying, which I think a lot of the people that are watching are wanting to, I guess, get a handle on, it's a tough time of year, in my opinion, to get a wheat rally. I do think some of the issues that we've had around the world as far as weather's concerned, you know, have been somewhat mitigated. I think that we've got good enough weather to have enough wheat. Now, inflationary-wise, is that going to help the wheat market? I absolutely think that it could if we do get some inflation, if the dollar continues to drop. I mean, we saw good export sales again this week, but I can't say that I'm bullish wheat. I struggle to get bullish, especially going into harvest. Corn and beans, I think, could be a bit of an anchor. I just don't see the wheat market being able to see new highs by any stretch of the imagination.
All right. Well, as we get through summer, of course, you mentioned we are looking ahead to harvest, but we're also coming through grilling season. Matt, when we think about meat demand, we've seen live cattle be in this upward trend since the depths of the COVID crisis earlier this spring. How much higher can we run here throughout the summer?
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, of course, I mean, this is a high demand time, and we know that a lot of folks haven't been able to go out to eat, but at the same time, we're all trying to grill, trying to just get outdoors and do something, you know, especially in the areas where people aren't able to get out and go as much as what we are in the rural areas. But, you know, what are we going to see for cattle price? I mean, I've said all along that I think if you could work through some of these heavier weights as far as your live cattle are concerned, I think that you could see some more strength later on. If I look at December cattle, I could see us getting into that 115, 117 area on down the road. I do think that there could be more upside here. I think beef demand is very strong. People are still going to want to eat a steak if they get a chance to do so, and I think that that's reflected, you know, in what your price structure is with a little bit of carry in this live cattle market.
Do you think we can get there with rolling shutdowns still in place throughout the economy, or do we really need restaurants open to move that live cattle price higher?
I kind of feel like if you really want to get the live cattle price exciting, you know, you're going to have to get your restaurants back open. But can we get to 115 without that happening? Yes. Or are we going to get above it without it happening? That might be a little bit more of a stretch. I'm making the assumption that as we move forward, we're going to find ways to open up, at least in some areas. I know that I'm no politician. I don't know a whole lot about, you know, all the ramifications of opening up everywhere. But I do think people are wanting to get back to normal, if at all possible. I mean, nobody wants to put anybody else in danger, but I do know people love to go out to eat, and they love to go out to eat on Friday night for a steak dinner.
You bet. Something to celebrate a little bit. Well, Matt Bennett, we always appreciate the chance to chat with you. Thanks for giving us your insights on where these markets are headed.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on the show, Mike.
It's 11 minutes before 6 o'clock news time. Glad to have you along for our weekly get-together here on the World of Agriculture on the Saturday morning show. And golly, I missed a party this week, but Max Armstrong was at the party and shares his impressions of that party. So it sounds like a good time, Max.
Orion, it was quite a celebration, quite a party to mark the 100th anniversary of the American Soybean Association. And it was held on a farm about 120 miles southeast of Chicago. Camden, Indiana was where we gathered with some other folks this week. Yeah, we got together for a meeting. Now we were, in fact, social distancing, and we were wearing masks there on the Fouts Family Farm at Camden, Indiana, where it all started with the American Soybean Association 100 years ago this summer, right after the First World War. The Fouts brothers, three brothers, Taylor, Noah, and Finus Fouts, had a seed company there. And they were growing soybeans. They wanted other farmers to grow beans. So they held a field day, and then eventually they formed what was called the National Soybean Growers Association. Just a few years later, the name was changed to the American Soybean Association. And the Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, Steve Sinske, was there this week. That was significant because not only is he an official from Washington who has a lot of impact on the soybean industry, but for 21 years, Steve Sinske was the chief executive officer for the ASA.
Congratulations to ASA for 100 years of great history of representing soybean farmers, and that's really something to celebrate, and how wonderful it is to be back here on the farm where it all started 100 years ago. I think the Fouts brothers would be very proud of what they've seen from the soybean industry and the association, and how it has grown over the last 100 years. Second of all, give a little bit of an update on some of the programs that we have ongoing from USDA. USDA has been a partner, of course, with farmers and the soybean industry for a lot of years. But talking about our coronavirus food assistance program, talk on some of the trade issues, China, the phase one deal, and how that's going, as well as the USMCA, Japan. And then looking to the future, talking a little bit about ag innovation and the importance of technology, and always keeping an eye on the future, which is appropriate as we celebrate 100 years, but also look forward to the next.
Since you alluded to it, and before I forget it, phase one, is it still on track, you feel?
Yeah, phase one is still on track. China has been purchasing, and they've been stepping up their purchases of agriculture commodities, as we've seen in the markets. We still think that they can do better, and they have more to do, but they have lived up to their agreement in terms of revising and eliminating, solving a lot of tariff and non-tariff trade issues that really were frustrations, sometimes for decades, that kept our products out of the Chinese market. We've taken care of those. And then, of course, the purchase commitments, and China has been stepping up. They still have further to go, but they say that they have every intent of living up to it, and we want to hold their feet to the fire as well.
They are shrewd traders. They've proven that over the years. Do they need us?
Well, certainly they do. We're one of the largest suppliers in the world, and of course we've seen that they have been purchasing. They do need our soy. They've been purchasing corn. Corn prices are way up in China, and we've seen some really huge corn purchases from the United States, which is great to see. Pork, beef, chicken, just a number of commodities, yes.
From the standpoint of watching that market develop over the years, where would it be had it not been for the United States soybean growers getting involved there? I mean, can't they take a significant amount of credit for that?
Sure. I think the soybean industry, the American Soybean Association, opened up its first office in the 1980s in China. And China was a net exporter then. But it was ASA leaders, state association leaders that really saw the potential for the future and said that, no, this is a big population. They want to improve their diets. They have rising incomes. And of course, China went from, of course, a net exporter to the largest import market in the world for soybeans, and including U.S. soybeans.
We'll find out next week, I guess, the potential size of this crop this year when the USDA report comes out. But it looks like a good one, does it not, from what you're seeing?
It sure does. I mean, all the anecdotal reports that I hear from across the country talking to farmers, it does look like we have a good crop coming. There's been some timely rains that have happened, and certainly from this trip that I've seen coming from Washington and landing in Indianapolis and then driving up here to Camden, the crop looks great.
I would ask you just to reflect back on your role with the ASA about the importance of the producer involvement, Steve.
You know, when you look at everything that's in play from a governmental affairs standpoint and all of the work that ASA does, how crucial is it that the soybean grower become a part of this?
It really is crucial that soybean growers, there was a reason why 100 years ago, soybean growers got together to form the American Soybean Association. It's because they recognized that if they wanted to grow the industry and have collective representation, they needed an association to do that. And that's just as true today as it was 100 years ago. And, you know, that's what I really count myself as fortunate. I was fortunate enough to serve as CEO of the American Soybean Association for 21 years. And it was the farmer leaders that are working and that are rank and file members, state association checkoff leaders, or national association and national checkoff leaders. The time, the effort that they're give to promote this industry, it wouldn't be where it is today without those farmer leaders.
Steve Sinske from Washington. The governor was there too, the Indiana governor there from Indianapolis. He had come out to help unveil a historic marker there along the highway, designating that as the birthplace of the American Soybean Association. Several Indiana farmers were in attendance, including Kendall Culp, who farms at Rensselaer, Indiana, and shared with you some thoughts about the ASA starting in his state.
They were growing soybeans from the early 1900s, and they actually were working with Purdue University and eventually helped develop some varieties and really brought soybean production to the forefront here in the Midwest.
I have to ask you, Kendall, weren't you a little bit surprised to learn that the association had its roots that far back?
Well, really, I was, and I didn't know that right here in Indiana is where they were born. You look at the all that American Soybean is associated with today and involved with, and all the good advocacy they do in Washington. I'm really glad the Fouts brothers had that foresight 100 years ago and brought us to where we are here today.
Kendall Culp, Indiana soybean grower. He farms right down the road at Rensselaer, Indiana. He's a member of the National Board of the American Soybean Association. Kendall is also the vice president of the Indiana Farm Bureau, Orient, and we had a visit with many friends from the past, many who asked to say hello to you as we gathered there at Camden, scene of the Fouts Farm. And if that name is familiar, Tom Fouts was a part of that family, and Tom was on the radio in Chicago. He was on the old Prairie Farmers Station over WLS back in the day when it was the Prairie Farmers Station, and Tom is Captain Stubby, who brought a lot of entertainment and a lot of joy to folks out in rural America.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock, and a quick look at those market sheets from yesterday. Grain market sheet totally red as we saw the prices for wheat, corn, and soybeans move lower for the day. The livestock screen has a little more color to it. There's some green as the hog market moved higher and the nearby cattle contract moved higher, but the other months were lower. So, again, that's our time. It goes quickly here on Saturday morning. My thanks to Bob Ferguson, who does the fine engineering work on this program for this hour.